You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by American Federation of Teachers, Kansas, and Elevator Constructors, Local 12. AFT Kansas is teachers, healthcare professionals, and employees of our universities, cities, counties, and state. Our mission is to build thriving communities by reclaiming the promise of strong public schools, of quality public services, and of healthy workplaces. And Elevator Constructors Local 12 installs, repairs, modernizes, and maintains elevators and escalators in the western half of Missouri and the entire state of Kansas. The safety of the riding public is always our priority. We thank our underwriters for their support, the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, like the Democratic Party here, the British Labor Party is flirting with an outspoken socialist to become their leader, and the unions are backing him. This week, the Heartland Labor Forum goes to England to find out who is Jeremy Corbyn. Then, we'll discuss the upsurge of opposition to testing in our schools. Can you measure the quality of a teacher by student test scores? We'll talk about it. That's tonight on the show. And in the news, Pitch article says TIFFs, like the one at for Cerner, are bad for workers. And Independence EMS workers stuck in negotiations for their first contract since last November. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. Her headlines are, one, former Massey CEO wants upper big branch explosion kept out of trial. Two, his fault, her fault, their fault, anyone but DuPont's fault. And three, MP Global in Nebraska tried to hide hazardous machines from safety inspectors. Now for the news.
This is the news from our site, September 3rd, 2015. The Pitch has an enlightening article this week by Steve Vachrot with the headline, As Cerner and Other Businesses Use TIF to Ensure Their Growth, Kansas and Missouri Keep Squeezing the Poorest Citizens. It's about how health information technology firm that makes more than $3 billion a year but is still getting $1.7 billion in taxpayer TIF support for their new office complex to be built on top of the old Bannister Mall site. According to Greg Leroy, executive director of the corporate subsidy research organization, Good Jobs First, the Cerner deal is the largest of its kind anywhere in the country. One major critique outsiders are offering on this deal relates to the type of office complex Cerner intends to build. They want to make facilities that compete with fancy amenities Google and Facebook and other tech giants offer their workers. It seems pretty obvious these workers aren't going to be coming from the Bannister Mall area. So there's frustration that taxpayers are forced to spend over $1 billion in creating a utopian workplace for tech workers who will mostly commute. Another major critique is that the money going to corporate subsidies for Cerner could be going to schools and libraries. Steve Potter, director of Mid-Continent Libraries, voted in favor of the TIF plan for Cerner, costing his library system $3 million. Considering the libraries are already closed on Sundays and Mid-Continent Public Library Administration feigned surprise when surveys from workers came back outraged that they had not seen any increase in wages in years, Potter could have at least symbolically voted no. His yes vote shows he's more concerned with fitting in with the KC business and political elite than standing up for his employees and customers at Mid-Continent Public Library. The Mid-Continent Public Library raised wages more or less in line to keep up with inflation this year, and most of their workforce still makes less than $15 an hour. Several years ago, UMKC economics professor Michael Kelsey has found that almost 90% of KC's TIF projects were concentrated in four of the city's six council districts. No surprise is the fact that third and fifth districts, which are actually facing unemployment and blight at larger levels than other districts because they are home to KC's traditionally marginalized and oppressed Eastside neighborhoods, get one out of every 10 or so TIF projects. All this goes to show that Missouri governments at the state and local level continue to feel they can take money from working families and dump it into the bank accounts of the business elite.
Jennifer Laird, a graduate student at University of Washington in Seattle, recently published a study about public employment after the Great Recession of 2008. According to Laird, sharp cuts in public spending after the economic downturn disproportionately affected Black women who worked in the public sector. According to Laird, this is very damaging for multiple reasons. One is that Laird believes many of the layoffs that happened right after the Great Recession happened in a hurry and were not done in a fair manner. Black women, being among the most vulnerable groups in American society, may have been targeted for layoffs. After the finding is that while public sector employment had long served a source of stable employment among Black Americans, often enabling mobility into the middle class, downsizing during the Great Recession disproportionately hurt Black workers and resulted in greater racial disparities in the public sector. Laird concluded that the Black public sector workers were more likely to become unemployed than their white or Hispanic counterparts. And even though Blacks would naturally be more affected by public spending cuts because they are statistically overrepresented in the public sector, Laird still found that the public sector employees lost their jobs at a higher rate than their white counterparts. Laird told Kim Crisberg of the public health blog The Pump Handle, "It's not just that unemployment rates were higher, it's that these were really good jobs with really transparent promotion ladders that were really high-paying relative to the private sector. So it's had direct implications for the Black middle class and upward mobility for Black workers." Another important finding from the study is that among unemployed public sector workers, Black women were least likely to find private sector employment and most likely to exit the labor market. The main takeaway, according to Laird, is that without a course correction, further efforts to dismantle the public sector will most likely have a negative effect on workers who have historically gained the most from public sector employment.
American Medical Response, a subsidiary of Envision Healthcare, a company traded on Wall Street, provides emergency medical support for the City of Independence. A year ago July, its workers voted to join the AFSCME. In November, they began negotiations with AMR for their first contract, and they're still at it because the union says the company won't budge on a number of key issues for the workers. First and foremost is staffing. The union says AMR needs more than its 102 workers to cover all the work. Currently, there are inadequate restrictions on holding workers over beyond the end of their 12-hour shifts, resulting in hundreds of hours a month in overtime and mandatory on-call shifts on their days off. Often because there's more money to be made in transferring patients from one healthcare facility to another than in answering 911 calls, the company assigns most ambulances to that and leaves too few ambulances to cover the true emergencies. Then, when a crew is at the end of their shift, calls come in and no other ambulance is available, so they get held over. Turnover is at least 23%. Although the union has requested the data to know exactly how much, they have not yet received it. AMR operates because of an exclusive permit granted by the City of Independence. The permit has performance requirements for response times, licensing of EMTs and paramedics, and vehicle maintenance, but it is silent on working conditions or respect for workers' rights. On Tuesday, the union went to visit Independence Director of the Health Department, Andrew Warland, to discuss their efforts to improve patient safety and employee burnout, and AMR's rejection of proposals that would improve retention and give licensed staff input into patient care issues. He said he'd inquire with the company, but could not do much more. The workers are concerned that at least 26% of them have less than 1 year experience and training is poor. They think the City of Independence should be concerned about that too. The union has been building support among the workers with a petition and march on the boss. Robert Mills, who has been an EMTB since 2001 and is a member of the bargaining committee, told us, "Currently here in Independence, we have an EMS system dominated by a national corporation traded on Wall Street. But local licensed emergency care personnel who staff the ambulances need a voice in our profession to ensure better patient outcomes in our community. This is why AMR employees voted overwhelmingly to join a union." The news tonight was read by Molly Bannon, Beth Pike, and Ariana Eckel.
About destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
Don't you know it's gonna be
alright? Alright, alright. You say you got a real solution. Ask me for a contribution. Well, you know, we all doing what we can. But if you want money for people with minds that hate, all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.
Don't you know it's gonna be
alright?
Hello, this is Jacob White, a volunteer with the Heartland Labor Forum. Last week, I was fortunate enough to speak with Mick Whelan. He is the Secretary General of a trade union in England that represents train engineers. We decided to have Mick on because the Labor Party in England, which is very similar to the Democratic Party in the United States, is also currently undergoing a process of selecting a new leader. The Labour Party in England has gone through some tumultuous times lately. In May 2015, they lost the general elections to the Conservatives, led by David Cameron, in what many consider to be an upset. One reason cited by many observers for why the Labour Party failed to take power is that they did not offer enough substantial policy changes to rally their base. Many people were expecting this round of selecting a new Labour Party leader to be rather boring. But the introduction of Jeremy Corbyn into the race has changed that. Many new voters are paying the £3, or about $8, necessary to join Labour and vote for Corbyn. He has been very popular with critics of England's foreign and economic policies. Among the controversial stands Corbyn has been willing to take in foreign policy include calling for the disbandment of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which he argues has not served any purpose since the fall of the Soviet Union and brings unnecessary burdens to England. In economic policy, Corbyn has taken a more traditional left-wing stance of putting people over profit, calling for a sharp increase in the minimum wage, as well as calling for the nationalization of England's energy and rail industries to ensure they are sustainable and accessible for generations to come. While many unions in the United States mull over whether to support Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primaries, in England, major unions have fully endorsed Corbyn. One major difference between England and the United States right now is that Bernie or Hillary could be leading the ruling party if they are elected in 2016, whereas Jeremy Corbyn would serve as opposition leader until 2020. I discussed these issues and more last week with Mr. Whelan. Here is part of our conversation. Mr. Whelan, we'd like to start off by asking you about your trade union and what type of workers you represent.
We represent train drivers, or as you know, locomotive engineers in the UK.
Here in Missouri, we've been battling with a conservative state government. It's constantly trying to push right-to-work laws, which are very damaging to how effective unions can be. In London, there are also a good number of politicians who seem determined to make trade unions ineffective. Can you talk about their efforts and how you're combating them?
Well, we traditionally have a long tradition of the right free association. We currently have the worst and most draconian trade union laws in Europe. And my view is that if people truly believe in what they're doing, they will always stand up for each other and stand for the right to strike. We currently have the right to strike, but it's guaranteed not under English law, because there's no right to strike under English law, but under the right to not be sued.
There's a few terms in British politics that would be very helpful for our listeners to understand, because they apply to both England and the U.S. in particular. I'm thinking about austerity and privatization. So what are austerity and privatization, and how have they impacted your industry?
Well, austerity is a false name for what happened with the worldwide banking crisis, which is used by dogma on the right wing in the UK to justify destroying public services, destroying welfare as we know it, and hurting our National Health Service. The reality is the year of austerity was the year that we paid back you guys Lendlease, which, if you look at Lendlease, a far greater lien on each individual in the UK than quite possibly the banking crisis ever would be. And the decision to pay back the banking crisis over 5 or 7 years was a political one. You could pay back over 50, 60 or 100.
The opposite of austerity would be an increase in public spending, and that's been one of the main things Jeremy Corbyn supports.
Truly. I mean, we know from the 20s, we know from the 30s, we know from your history, from worldwide history, even Japan in the 80s, that the way out of austerity is to actually buy your way out of austerity. And what you do then is you build public services, you build roads, you build dams, you build hospitals, you build railways, you employ people, you create apprenticeships, you generate money for the construction industry and elsewhere, for transport industries, and then you move from there.
And infrastructure is definitely another issue that the United States and the UK have a lot of extra spending they could be doing on. So what are some of the things that Jeremy Corbyn has promised as far as improving British national infrastructure?
Well, he's actually put forward a vision whereby we've been very regressive in what we do. We don't look 10, 20, 30 years in advance what we need. We go from, oh dear, we should have done this, we'll do it now, to rather than looking, having a vision for what we need for generations to come. And what Jeremy's saying is, we'll create an investment bank, we'll invest in our own infrastructure. If there are services to be gained from what we invest in, we'll take them back for the public good. And I think that's striking a resonance with the public.
And how has privatization affected the railways particularly? I know that renationalizing the railway system seems to be a fairly popular program across the board in Britain.
Well, the reality is you've got to look at two decades of false promises. The promise of privatization was it would drive down fares, it would drive investment, and it would drive innovation. And privatisation of the UK railways has failed in all three. In the last 5 years since 2010, fares have gone up to 25%. We've had no innovation, and investment still comes centrally from government. So there is no real rationale for maintaining the system on the model that we've got.
And I know that the Labour's position in the 2015 elections was kind of controversial, and the government wound up raising the minimum wage to higher than Miliband proposed. So Corbyn has been more aggressive about raising the minimum wage. Is that correct?
Truly. I mean, the reality is the minimum wage, when the Labour Party first suggested many years ago, was a great idea. But then it became the headline figure. It wasn't meant to be the maximum. It was meant to be the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And now we talk in terms of a living wage, and Jeremy talks about giving a living wage to everybody where they live.
So you recently signed a letter along with some other major trade union leaders in England supporting Corbyn. How has the response been to that, and what do your political opponents think of Corbyn?
Well, we have our political opponents will always disregard what we say or will see to undermine it. The reality with most people in the UK, people see a resonance in that having a real dialogue, having a real debate rather than having parties fight for a middle ground where you can't see a difference between them is the way forward. So we believe you create that debate, you create a real policy for the future, and you create a real reaction, what people truly want for their kids, their families, and dignity in retirement for many years to come.
Were people in England surprised at first when the major trade unions came out in support of Corbyn? And was that a change in policy position for the main labour unions?
Not really. I mean, some went with the party machine, and some, as they always did, tended to be further on the left. We traditionally have been further on the left. And the reality is, we believe the last manifesto that wasn't successful in the last election was one of the most dramatic that we had, but nobody knew about it. Actually, having someone who espouses the same views, puts them out there, creates that debate, is the right place to be.
And from some lists that I've been reading about why people support Corbyn, one of the main frustrations, it seems, on the British left today is about the House of Lords and about how it kind of gets in the way of a people's democracy. So could you talk about some of the criticisms of the House of Lords?
Well, the reality is the House of Lords has a vast amount of still traditionally people who are there because of where they've been in the past. And when one of those hereditary peers dies, they elect another one. The rest of the House of Lords on grace and favour. How then do we have a second chamber that gives real transparency, real objectivity, and drives real politics forward if it's done on a sort of basis? So we will always have a concern that where you came from gives you authority and a view rather than what you should be doing.
Corbyn has also made his name for himself representing some more marginalized positions in British society, such as homeless people. And what's his position on the refugee crisis in Europe right now, and what are trade unions' positions?
Well, trade union position is that we are an island nation, and migration, where it's for political, for real refugee status, we're not doing enough. Illegal immigration, we need to be ensuring that people are looked after, but they should be where they should be and how dealt with in an appropriate way. And we've got a real view that none of Europe, including ourselves, are doing this adequately.
Corbyn, he's going to be the opposition leader. Could you just go into some of the technical, like Why is there an election right now for a leader, and how long has the election been going? When does it end?
Well, we recently had a national election where the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, who they called Red Ed, who was technically trying to take us back to the left, lost. All the polls up to that election said that Labour were going to win, or they might just shade it, we might go into coalition. And the reality was, when the election came to fruition, that wasn't the case. Some of that was because the previous Liberal Party had been in coalition with the Tories or the right wing. Their votes didn't go where we thought they'd go. Because of the immigration issue, there's been a rise of a party called UKIP, and some of their votes detracted from the normal vote that Labour would have had. And the Labour leader decided, having not succeeded, they should stand aside and create an election for a new Labour leader with 5 years to go before the next election. He's done that. Four people have stood forward. All good people, all with slightly different varying views about where the Labour Party should go. And some of us on the left of the trade union movement have decided that Jeremy offers the best option because we believe that's the way forward.
Do you think some of his popularity, I mean, he's known for being, people see him as a straight talker, kind of like Bernie Sanders in America. Do you think some of his popularity also derives from, you know, in America, we always have Hillary Clinton went to Yale Law School and Bush went to Yale, and it always feels like people are coming from Yale or Harvard and or Oxford or Cambridge in England. And do you think some of his popularity comes from the fact that he doesn't have that background?
Yeah, there's a big feeling of that in the UK. I mean, the reality is our politics have become what we call over here, you leave universities having done PPE, politics, philosophy and economics. You become a researcher or a spad for an MP, and then whatever party you're in, you simply funneled into the political process. That's not saying that all lawyers, all people in Harvard, all people in Oxford, Cambridge don't have conviction politics. Mm-hmm. But the reality is you actually want a government, whether it be your Senate, whether it be our Parliament, that's formed with well-rounded people with real-life experience. I think there is a feeling out there across the board that real-life experience has to come back to our Parliament so people feel they've been fully represented.
And Jeremy Corbyn also supports levelling out opportunities for education. He plans to roll back tuition costs in England?
Well, yeah, we've had a long tradition in the UK that education's free at the point of contact, health is free at the point of contact. I believe that's the way forward. If you truly want to get the best out of society in your communities, you have to offer the opportunities for people from all sectors, regardless of their background and their financial well-being, to have the best education possible. And also, I believe if you pay your taxes, then that education should be free at the point of contact. And if all of a sudden you're saying to people, you're going to have to pay, I don't know, equivalent of $15,000 a year to go to college or university and pay subsistence, our traditional system fails itself because people are ready for it.
So Corbyn is a very exciting opportunity for people who support labor and support workers. And what other things in these next, 3 or 4 years could you see going on that's politically exciting in the UK? I've seen there's been a lot of activism around hotel workers and restaurant workers. Is there anything else in particular that American people in the Midwest should be keeping our eye on?
Well, I think, we need to re-energize the right that all workers should have a decent standard of living, that anything they generate, they should get a share in. Mm-hmm. I mean, we very much believe in a stakeholder society. And the reality is where we've moved in the West for many years to zero-hours contracts, a service-driven economy whereby people don't actually live on what they earn, but live on what tips or whatever else they get, isn't the way to drive people forward. And if you want to encourage social mapping, if you want to encourage career mapping, you want to encourage real enthusiasm that grows the community, that grows the economy for everybody, people have to feel part of it. And I think that may well come out of what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
And the next 3 or 4 years are important because they run up to the next national elections. And when are those? And that's the earliest that you can elect a new prime minister, right?
We can, but in the interim, we can oppose and we can challenge the dogma and the dichotomy that's coming out. We've become, since the 80s, a very selfish society. and the work society has gone into the background. I mean, Maggie Thatcher, Milton Friedman and Reagan Economics very much said we were a society of individuals. Well, we in Britain never truly believed that. And I believe with Jeremy Corbyn enthusing people to be part of a stakeholder society, it isn't about taking away from the right people to invest. It's not about not growing business. You actually want to grow business. You actually want to grow jobs. You actually want to grow the economy. But you also want to feel that the people who contribute to that get a fair share of what goes on. And they get a decent standard of living and a decent opportunity for their children, and more importantly, possibly in this day and age, for their parents and grandparents going into degree of dignity into retirement.
And the National Health Service is another one where it's everything is free at the point of service, and protecting that is very important to Corbyn, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, our National Health Service, we have two world wars, which you guys are heavily involved in, that created a land for the heroes and heroines, which was going to be people would have decent housing, decent education. But more importantly, after having paid and not being able to afford health service, would have health service free at the point of where you required it. And I think that anything that undermines that takes away from something that we fought for and generated and should, you know, enshrine. The reality is, if you pay your taxes, you pay your national insurance, you have a right and an enshrined right to be where you need to be.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us today, sir.
It's an absolute privilege. Thank you.
All right, that was Mick Whelan. He's the General Secretary of ASLEF, which represents locomotive engineers in the UK. And he recently published a letter in support of Jeremy Corbyn for Leader of Labour, in addition to five other major trade union activists. We're very lucky to have him on today. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Join myself, JZ, host of Mind the Gap, on the Thursday night special for the end of summer Sunday Solace Party for KKFI, September 6th from 3 to 8 p.m. on the patio at Californo's Westport. I'll have DJ Giovanni, Too Heavy, DJ the DJ, Avant Garde, and myself on the decks for sun, music, drinks, and fun. That is KKFI Sunday Solace, presented by Mind the Gap, September 6th from 3 p.m. It is the closing summer party of the season, so don't sleep on it. Be there.
Men, women, and the friction in between. That's the subject matter for the next Shots in the Night Radio Theater program, this Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on KKFI, Kansas City's community radio.
On the front lines, abroad and at home, on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
90.1, in cooperation with the Kansas City Volunteer Lawyers and Accountants for the Arts, would like to invite you to come to a seminar called Nonprofit Best Board Practices, Thursday, September 10th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., 3901 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Learn what responsibilities board members have on nonprofits, from fiscal responsibilities to fiduciary duties. Learn what you need to be doing if you are a board member, or what you need to be instructing your board members on if you are running a nonprofit organization. KCVLAA.org for online registration.
Well, teachers invented testing, so I'm not against testing. I'm not against assessment. But what I am against is the inundation of our classrooms with standardized testing. It's gotten completely out of hand. You know, one parent in Chicago, when I went to speak there, told me their kindergartner takes 14 standardized tests a year. And this allows for no time for teaching. And I'm glad that you raised Finland, because in Finland, one of the highest ranked school systems in the world, they only have one standardized test. And let me just say that I think we need to reframe what the purpose of education is, because I think it's not just about career ready and college ready. I think it's also about solving real life problems that we have in our world. We have endless wars, economic stagnation, and we have mass incarceration, and climate change is threatening the future of humanity. And none of those problems can be solved by bubbling A, B, C, or D. I think we need to teach critical thinking and collaboration. I think we need to teach imagination and civic courage in our classrooms. And these tests are too small, too puny, to measure all the skills my kids have. And I would suggest that we move to a system like Finland, where we do performance-based assessments, like when you get your PhD.
right? They don't have you fill in bubbles at the PhD level because they want you to be able to think, and you got to defend your evidence in front of a panel of experts. And I say, let's develop that in every grade level, in every subject, where you actually have to do research over time, defend a thesis, and actually explain yourself, right? A much better form of assessment in my.
And that was Jesse Hagopian. I'm Judy Ansel. That clip comes from MSNBC Melissa Harris Perry show. Jesse's the author of a book called More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. Well, we tried to get Jesse on tonight, but he couldn't be with us. And so Dane Zeller, who's a new volunteer with the Heartland Labor Forum and a college teacher, was going to interview him, but instead I'm going to interview Dane about the book, which he read. Dane's also qualified to do this because he's a teacher and because he's married to a school counselor. Welcome to the show, Dane.
Good to be here.
And we'll get you actually anchoring an interview, I'm sure, shortly. But for now, I'm going to interview you.
All right.
So tell us, first off, who is Jesse Hagopian?
He is, by trade, a history teacher in Garfield High School in Seattle, Washington. He is known mostly for the boycott he led in 2013 against the MAP test given by his school district, and was quite successful with it.
Uh-huh. Well, and I just noticed today that tonight the Seattle National Education Association, Teachers Association, is having a strike vote, and because their negotiations are stalled, and one of the issues that's on their list of what they want is, as they put it, reasonable testing.
Yes.
So it's a big issue there.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Garfield High School was just the site of one of the protests and the boycott. There were probably about four high schools involved in it, and it continues even in 2015. And this vote to strike is probably representative of that problem they have with the administration.
Okay. Well, you teach at the School of Business. You teach management, actually, at Avila.
Mm-hmm.
And Dane's also a former business owner of a printing company. So what got you interested in reading this book, Dane?
Well, it's a natural development, I believe, of my teaching management at the post-secondary level. As a college instructor, I help create the single number that stands for the education of a college student. That's the GPA. I contribute to that. And I can see how insufficient that number is in capturing the quality of an education that a student has gotten. Furthermore, my wife is a counselor in Kansas City, Missouri School District, and I've heard
a lot. And a union member.
And a union member. And I've heard lots of stuff about MAP testing in Missouri, and her opinions are really have to do with the length of time it takes to take the test and the length of time to prepare for it. So that's how I was interested. When I saw this title, More Than a Score, I knew immediately what he meant by that.
Yeah. Well, our students clearly are more than a score, and our teachers are more than a score.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it the new uprising against high-stake testing. First off, what's high-stakes testing?
Well, it would be, in this context, it means a multiple-choice test that has been created by a testing company that standardizes these tests, and which is a way of finding out how students perform in reading and math and science. But it's what's done with them that's the problem. Some people want teachers to be judged by the results of these tests, and that really makes it high stakes, because a teacher must then prepare the student not for an education but for a number.
Okay, So that's what makes it high stakes, because people can lose their jobs, right?
They don't admit to that, but you must know that teachers are judged on that at the end of the year.
Right. And a lot of people think that's reasonable, but a lot of teachers don't. And I know I hear complaints all the time from teachers I know about the obsession with testing. We see it at the college level, because I teach at UMKC. There's an obsession with what's called assessment. Mm-hmm. And it's all a numbers game. Mm-hmm. It's how do you score? And so I could relate to this title too. So there's a lot of grumbling. There's a lot of complaining. But the teachers at Garfield High School actually took it in their own hands to refuse to give the test. What happened there?
They boycotted it. This was in 2013. I believe it's February in the spring of 2013. And just think about that. If even if you're a member of a union, which they were, you wonder, is this violating our contract? Will I have a job next year? Because I'm just going to flat refuse to do something that may well be in the contract that I should conduct these tests. But they decided 100% to not give the test and not participate in it.
Which test didn't they give?
It's called the MAP test, Measurement of Academic Progress. It comes out of the No Child Left Behind movement, and it is mainly a test of reading and math.
Who designs that test? Is that done by some private corporation?
There's a company in the Northwest that I believe it was called Northwest Educational Association or something like that, that made the test. Incidentally, one of the complaints at Garfield High was that the superintendent of schools, who approved this test and bought it for $4 million, served on the board of that testing company.
Oh, wow. That's
so, and that's a lot of what Jesse and his colleagues complain about. The profit motive, the corporate involvement, all the push to do this, to measure just this limited amount of qualities in an educated person.
Right. And, you know, I'm constantly getting ads from vendors who want to sell me educational packages and, you know, I mean, way beyond textbooks, you know, programs and all sorts of stuff like that. There is a growing business in this kind of thing, which, you know, is in many ways makes a lot of teachers uncomfortable, I think. So tell me, what happened? What was the outcome of this boycott?
Most students opted out of it, and it did not go through. And the result of it was a task force to study the problem. And I believe the superintendent and other administrators decided that they may have had a point. And so they changed their policy to administer this test the following year only to elementary and middle school schools. And that's what they did.
So the high school teachers got an exemption, but the elementary and middle school teachers didn't.
That's true. And may I say there was a lot of cooperation from parents and students. And, I mean, I'm
with
not...
With the teachers.
With the teachers to actually opt out of the testing. I don't know if that's legal or not, but they did it.
Is that true here in Missouri that parents can get their students, their kids to opt out of the test?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. All right. So I mean... What are the major objections to this kind of standardized testing?
There are bags full of them. first of all, I look on it as a big picture. And I look at it as a tool that's been produced that is so important and has so much importance attached to it that, in fact, it drives education, that it is simply a tool that almost defines what an education is. I mean, on four bubbles on a standardized test, you're going to answer one of them, you're going to pick one, and that's going to tell what you know about whatever. And so those tests cannot measure how curious students are, don't measure how well they dance, doesn't measure how well they create artwork, doesn't measure how well they behave. It tries to, but it just does not test the things that we know are part of a quality education. And that occurs in the elementary school on up through college.
What do they test?
Reading, the ability to read, and do math in
That's
Washington.
It?
Yeah. There are other standard tests that are used about the country that go beyond that, and but nothing that really gets into the real definition of education.
So at Garfield High School, they got rid of the test, but they didn't get rid of the test for the whole Seattle School District. So are they planning more actions?
Well, yes. In fact, they had to take action because there was another, I don't know what to call it, but a new movement afoot, a centralized movement called Common Core, I believe. And mm-hmm. also there was Race to the Top. These are movements that come filter down, and
they come out of the private sector, don't they?
They probably do.
Yeah,
and that's what gives them the impetus, the momentum. And in fact, in 2015, this year, they had to have another boycott of a Common Core or Race to the Top test, and they boycotted it, and so did the students. And only 5% of the students took the new exam. And so
not going to get very valid results from that. Oh, my. Well, you know, one of the things that I've objected to is, you know, a few years ago, my program, the labor education program at UMKC, tried to get more labor education in our high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the constant objection we ran into was, we don't have time to teach that because we're too busy preparing for the test.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have this, I mean, it's a form of standardization that's really going on here in our schools, where what is taught is dictated by folks who you don't even know who they are and are really not accountable and approved by politicians, I guess, but and who are making money off of it. And they're determining what our children are, what's the priorities for them to learn.
Sure.
And the rest of what we all might think is important for the kids to learn just doesn't get taught. It gets squeezed out.
And that was one of Jesse's group's criticism, is that standardized tests limit what they teach. Obviously they do, because they have to take time to take the test. And they have to take a lot of time to prepare, and other things get edged out, like things that are not easily measured.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other another criticism of standardized tests, is that they just are objective and can only measure a response from a student, cannot measure how well they get along with other people, how happy they are, how curious they are.
Well, that's not education.
Oh, yes, it is.
I mean, you know, like you're supposed to get that at home, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, you can get that at home. But at least what I think in my college class is, I think, and I'm teaching usually principles of management, and what I see is I wonder if that is my purpose, just to regurgitate something from a textbook, or do I want them to be able to learn better when they've left my classroom?
Uh-huh.
That is hard to judge.
Well, from the worker's point of view, as a teacher as worker,
mm-hmm.
What's going on in education is actually something that went on in the workplace, like factories, 100 years ago, and it's called scientific management or
sure.
Taylorism.
Uh-huh.
And it's where management and people who are not directly doing the work take over absolute control of the worker and how much time mm-hmm. the worker spends on things, what the worker can do, and all discretion. And teachers are supposed to be professionals.
Yeah.
Taken away from them.
Yeah, and the most grievous example of that is the ranking of employees and what's called rank and yank, because you've come to some numerical decision about 10% of your employees are not matching up, so they get fired. And that is one of the problems with just thinking of people as numbers.
And they have to get rid of 10%, because aren't these tests designed so that there's always going to be 10% who fail?
By definition, the bell-shaped curve.
Oh, my gosh. So, okay, so one last question, because we're just about out of time. What is the purpose of education? In the beginning, in the clip we played in the beginning, Jesse talks about the purpose of education, you know, teaching people to solve the problems of the world. And he listed off a whole bunch of, do you agree with that?
I do. And there are other things, too, that because we are in the internet world, we believe that after we're out of college, through the internet and through our new networking, we can teach ourselves. We can learn ourselves. And how are you going to do that if you're just regurgitating facts that your professor tells you?
It sounds like one of the things you think goal of education should be is teaching people how to learn.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
To be teachers of them.
So that you can go on learning your whole life.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Dane Zeller.
You're welcome.
And the book is called More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. It sounds like a real interesting read.
It
is. The author is Jesse Hagopian. I'm Judy Ansel. Thanks.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, Blankenship wants Upper Big Branch explosion kept out of trial. From Ken Ward Jr. at www.wvgazettemail.com for July 24th. Former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship's lawyers don't want the jury in his criminal trial to hear any evidence about the Upper Big Branch mine explosion or about the cause of or responsibility for the April 2010 blast that killed 29 miners. Last Friday, July 24th, attorneys for Blankenship filed a motion asking U.S. District Judge Irene Berger to instruct jurors in the case that the trial does not concern the UBB explosion, the cause of the explosion, or responsibility for the explosion. Blankenship faces three felony counts alleging that he conspired to violate federal mine safety standards, worked to thwart U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration inspectors, and lied to the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission and to the investing public about Massey's safety practices. While the indictment does not specifically allege that Blankenship was responsible for the Upper Big Branch disaster, it does focus on events at the time. The indictment outlines repeated violations at the UBB mine of federal safety rules meant to prevent mine explosions, such as those mandating proper ventilation and control of highly explosive coal dust. Also, defense lawyers asked Berger to exclude all references to mine explosions, prevention of mine explosions, and condition conductive to mine explosions. Trial is scheduled to start on October 1st with proceedings in Charleston Federal Court. Next, his fault, her fault, their fault, anyone but DuPont's fault. From the pump handle at scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for August 26th. It was paltry. It was pathetic. That's what Celeste Montfortin, doctor of public health, thought of OSHA's proposed $99,000 penalty to DuPont for safety violations related to the November 2014 death of four employees. OSHA dinged the company for one repeat and nine serious violations. The employees were asphyxiated by methylmercaptan because of gross failures in DuPont systems to manage highly hazardous chemicals. The penalty amount is so insignificant it wouldn't even appear on a DuPont financial statement. Rather than pay the fine and admit responsibility, DuPont is contesting the OSHA violations. On what grounds? DuPont says OSHA rules are vague, the rules don't apply, and worst of all, the violations were the workers' fault. In a document submitted for its challenge to the agency's violations, DuPont claims more than a dozen reasons why OSHA is wrong. The most offensive has to be this one. The violations alleged are in part or in whole due to unpreventable employee misconduct. Wait a minute. OSHA inspectors found pressure valves, flanges, and vents not configured consistent with the plant's piping and instrument diagrams. But that wasn't the only problem at the plant. As Lise Olson in www.texasmonthly.com wrote, the unit's pipes were often clogged, forcing workers to make potentially risky repairs to avoid costly production delays. And the unit's ventilation fans on the roof weren't functioning, increasing risk of harmful exposure. Finally, MP Global in Nebraska tries to hide hazardous machines from safety inspectors. At www.osha.gov for at What's New, a Norfolk, Nebraska flooring materials company tried to hide hazardous machines from federal inspectors during an investigation into why a 65-year-old temporary worker suffered the amputation of one finger and severe damage to another when his left hand was caught as he operated a machine. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspectors found the man's employer, MP Global Products LLC, attempted to conceal an entire production line from them. Inspectors found numerous machines lack safety guards that exposed workers to amputation injuries on that line and throughout the facility. Workers also told inspectors the company threatened to fire those who told inspectors about their safety concerns. OSHA cited MP Global on August 26 for two willful, 22 serious, and one other than serious safety violations, carrying proposed penalties of $244,000. The agency also placed the company in OSHA's Severe Violator Enforcement Program after the inspection of the March 1, 2015 injury. MP Global manufactures underlayment products from recycled materials for use beneath laminate, tile, and hardwood flooring. These products are sold by nationwide distributors such as Home Depot, Lumber Liquidators, Menards, Wayfair, and Build Direct. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
Tonight's Heartland Labor Forum calendar, September 3rd, 2015. Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum, Pain in the Arrears, Debts That Can't Be Serviced, Won't. Jacob Bosch, Friday, September 4th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's tomorrow. Westport Flea Market Bar and Grill, 817 Westport Road. Rally for $15, sponsored by Stand Up KC. Thursday, September 10th, 11:45 a.m. at Pioneer Park at Broadway Boulevard and Westport Road. The Pope may be going to D.C., but Sister Simone and the nuns are on the bus to coming to Kansas City to talk about economic justice. That's Friday, September 11th at Town Hall Meeting, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Community Christian Church, 4601 Main, Kansas City, Missouri. Rally to stop a right-to-work veto override with Governor Jay Nixon and Teamsters International President James P. Hoffa. Saturday, September 12th, 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Teamsters Hall, 4501 Emanuel Cleaver Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. Alliance for Retired Americans annual Gerald Randall Luncheon honoring Representative Judy Morgan. Wednesday, October 14th, 11 a.m. at the Argosy Casino. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Like us on Facebook. Just search for Heartland Labor Forum. Send us your feedback about the show and what do you want to hear? What did you like or hate? Volunteer for the Heartland Labor Forum. Call us at 816-235-1470.
And we also podcast. So just go to iTunes or whoever you get your podcast from. Do a search for Heartland Labor Forum, and you can get us that way, too. But, of course, we love KKFI. Tune in next week to the show. We're going to do an update on the United Auto Workers negotiations with the major auto companies. No more tears, and a new crop of women leaders report back from the Midwest School for Women Workers. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.